So let's get into the film proper now. So the film starts with the drum beats from The Streets of Philadelphia by Bruce Springsteen, and there's various clips featuring the streets of Philadelphia throughout.
We see Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks sitting side by side talking to a judge, both stating their arguments for the case. Now, Hanks represents the powerful development organization, whereas Washington is representing the residents in the affected area. Now, this is very much feels like David versus Goliath, which surprisingly, actually, Hanks is representing the Goliath in this situation.
Yeah, in this early stage, I thought, is he playing a villain in this film? I don't remember him being villainous, but it came across in this short scene. But then following that, Beckett is seen working, but he's at some type of clinic getting some treatment done. Clearly very dedicated to his job. And there's a comment made, I think it's one of the doctors walked past and said some comment about his blood work being fine. So I guess there's nothing to worry about, right?
Indeed, yeah, because it doesn't explicitly mention it yet, does it? So Beckett's dedication is shown again as he's working late and he's eating some takeout, but he's summoned upstairs to meet the partners.
Yeah, the note I made here was this was very much like old boys club mentality. It's just that kind of old-fashioned, middle-class, old white men run things is about as stereotypical as it can get. Beckett's got a promotion. He's been made one of the senior associates, and they're having a chat about this new profile case that he's got. And one of the partners notices what looks like a bruise or a lesion on Beckett's forehead, and Beckett kind of plays it down, doesn't he? Does he say it's... A tennis injury or something? He makes some comment.
Tennis or squash,
yeah,
wasn't
something
it?
Along
yeah.
Those lines.
So we have our first mini time jump. So there are a number of little time jumps throughout the film. So this jumps 9 days later. Now, more lesions have appeared on Andrew, and Andrew is having some makeup applied to help hide them.
Now, Andrew goes to the bathroom. He's experiencing a really painful stomach, and then he says he needs to go to the hospital. Now, at this point, one of the people that's in the room with him makes a comment along the lines of, oh, it's just like my cousin Fredo. So the people in the room clearly know what's wrong with Andrew, but it's not been explicitly said yet, so the audience may or may not know, I guess is the point of the day. You know, there's something they know, but it's not been made clear to the audience yet.
Yeah, indeed. So we have our second time jump, and this time it jumps 1 month later. And we see Miller is present for the birth of his daughter. He even takes a couple of selfies with his wife and newborn baby. Now, my wife, you know, she... Sorry, Andy, I haven't mentioned this. So when I've mentioned this in the past, but when we first started to watch this, the wife wasn't bothered about watching it. So I've told you before, you know, you could tell she's getting ready for hibernation. She's laid down. She's got all the pillows around her, blankets. So, but I just want to say she actually stayed awake for the whole film. So the wife made a comment here and she said, oh, typical that Joe's wife is helping Joe with the camera, having just gone through labour. So the wives are sticking up for themselves. For each other, should I say.
I did think the same, to be honest. I mean, she's been through an ordeal. We're a week later and we see Miller in his office with a man in a sling.
I've mentioned that my wife has this thing, you know, face blindness, air quotes. So she made a comment here and she said something like, oh, this film has got a really good cast. And I think, well, obviously we've seen Denzel and Tom Hanks. So I said like, oh, why? Why do you say that? And she said, well, that man sitting there with the arm sling is Gerard Butler. And I was like, what? Gerard Butler? This film is like made in the 90s. Gerard Butler. I wonder how old he would have been then. And then I just said, oh, the dreaded face blindness strikes again. But then when he started walking to the door, when Joe Miller like shows him out, she went, oh, yeah, that's not Gerard Butler. But it looks nothing like Gerard Butler.
I cannot see the resemblance in any way, shape, or... I mean, I can't remember who the guy is, but I know it's not Gerard Butler or anyone remotely who looks like Gerard Butler.
Is this the... I would say an older man, slightly over middle-aged, with a beard, and that is as close as Gerard Butler as you're going to get.
Yeah, that's a vague... a vague case of face blindness at best. Now, Andrew comes into the office at this point, and they have a conversation. He's, you know, I was obviously wanting to start a case with him. And Andrew tells Joe that he has AIDS. Now this was really quite... It was a weird scene, because Joe instantly moves away, and you know they've just shaken hands, haven't they? And you can see he kind of like wipes his hand on his trousers. He's really nervous about being so close to him and having touched his hand. And then he sees Andrew pick up a cigar and put it back in the case, and he puts his hat down on some papers too. And all the while, Joe is just looking at all these things, and you can tell there's a fear setting in, isn't there?
There is, and I don't think we've commented on the show notes, Andy, but you've obviously mentioned when the film came out in 93, but I don't recall seeing in the film any mention of what year the film took place. Do you? Because in the 80s is when HIV really hit, wasn't it? But it was still unknown, so I wonder whether, was this set in the 80s or was it set like in 93, for example? Because I think if it's in the 80s, it's still very much unknown, isn't it? And because obviously I'm going to talk about he goes to the doctor, doesn't he, soon?
It would have been, it wasn't explicitly said, but I think even if it was based on the time, you know, early 90s, it's still quite fresh, isn't it? So I don't think there would have been enough time for things to have evolved to an extent. So there's still that, there's probably... a knowledge, but there's still trepidation, I guess, would be the polite way of saying it.
Yeah, so Andrew informs Joe that he's been sacked and explains a bit about his case. However, Joe declines the case, and he just admits it. He says he doesn't want it for personal reasons. So I've just meant, you know, touched on this. So we see Joe now with his doctor. And the doctor is educating Joe on how AIDS is spread between people. And he's kind of giving him some reassurance that, you know, he's not being infected, for example. He gets a needle out to draw some blood, but Joe doesn't actually have any blood drawn. So later on, Joe is discussing things with his wife, and he openly tells his wife that he's homophobic.
Yeah, this scene was very well acted. But it's one of those eye-opening scenes that kind of explains just what's going off. So I think it's actually his wife says to him, "You're homophobic," and he admits as such, doesn't he? And he uses some very derogatory, discriminatory language. We're not going to repeat that for obvious reasons. But it really sets the tone for what his view is, and maybe what public opinion was in some quarters. In a weird way, I kind of think it was necessary to have that level of language, just to really hit home the point of what people's viewpoints are. I think if you skirt around the issue, it doesn't become quite so impactful. So although, of course, we wouldn't approve or endorse that kind of language, the fact that he is using it, I think, is important for the evolution of the film, because you see just exactly what his real opinions are. There's no mistaking what his thoughts are. You know, there's no vagaries about it. This is his viewpoint, and he is very clear about it in a pretty nasty way, has to be said. We get another short time jump 2 weeks later. Joe is in a public library doing some research, and some bloke is staring at Joe, probably because he's black. So, you know, discrimination works in many ways, and he's on the receiving end of it, whether he knows it or not. We also see that Andrew is in there, and he's researching his own case against his old employers. The librarian brings a book to Andrew, and he confirms that it does indeed have a reference or passage to HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, and the librarian also makes a comment about using a private room instead. And people nearby seem visibly awkward too, about the situation and finding out that Andrew has AIDS, or you know, potentially has AIDS. They don't know for certain, but you know, that's the assumption they've made. And Joe can see this happening, and he walks over to Andrew, and after a brief conversation, Joe sits down and they talk. Now, this is a very good scene, because it's highlighting to the audience the different prejudices that both characters are facing, that Andy kind of touched on just a second ago.
It is indeed, and it kind of begins their professional relationship at this point, doesn't it? So later on, We're at a stadium. I think it's watching the basketball. And Joe serves a summons to Charles Wheeler and his partners. They're not happy. They go out into the corridor and have a bit of a conversation. And one of the partners, Bob, seems very reluctant. And he says something like, where is your compassion? However, the others pressure him into saying that he knows nothing about Andrew's AIDS status.
Then we have a scene where Andrew goes back to his childhood home to see his parents and family. And as Andrew's going there, he shows the handprints in a concrete that he made as a child and signed it as Andy. So my little comment, because obviously we've watched Woody, we've obviously watched Toy Story recently. So Woody has become Andy. I thought that was nice because obviously throughout the notes we've mentioned Andrew as Andrew, but this is a tie where he clearly sees that he references himself as Andy. I thought that's a nice little throwback to Toy Story there.
Well, a throw forward, actually, because of the release time. But yeah, so I wonder whether Toy Story got it from this film. But I immediately thought of Toy Story as well. It's quite interesting. So we get another time jump, longest so far. We jump forward by 7 months, and we're at the start of the court case. And the counsellors, each side's counsel, maybe using the wrong term, but they kind of make their opening statements, don't they? And I think it's really being set up as it's legality versus morality.
It is indeed. And also the time jumps help, doesn't it, with the deterioration in Andrew's health as well. So it doesn't happen overnight. It's over a course of months, potentially a year maybe when we get to the end, that you can see his deterioration on screen. Outside of the courthouse, we see protesters on both sides, some supporting Andrew, but also people against homosexuality. Now, one of the protesters approaches them and shouts, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Yeah, one of the witnesses in the case is a female with AIDS. She contracted it through a blood transfusion. So it's kind of coming across that that's not really the same thing, is it? And I believe she even makes a comment that she doesn't see herself as any different to Andrew, but the way the court case is playing out and the way that she's being questioned and treated, they're clearly treating her as a different case, like it's not her fault.
Yeah, because one of the partners mentions that, doesn't he, later on, saying it wasn't her fault that she got it.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't remember which one it is, but one of the partners was. Later, we see Joe being approached by a student who's studying law at Penn State. Everything seemed fine. He's got some compliments on how he's handling the case. But then the student tries to chat Joe up, and Joe doesn't take kindly to this. Now, Joe makes a few homophobic remarks to the student, and he leaves the shop. Now, the wife made a comment here, Andy, and she said it looked like Joe was shoplifting as he walked out because he hadn't paid for any items, and he had like a handful, didn't he? Armfuls. He was holding a few different items, I think for the baby, wasn't it, from memory?
Yeah, he had a bunch of nappies under his arms, and I thought the same thing. He made a right mess as well. There was like pills or bottles and stuff on the shelf that he made a mess of. Another scene that kind of gives you an idea of what Joe's mindset is still at this stage. You know, he's not really changed his viewpoint as things stand. Later on, Andrew and Miguel are hosting a party. And Joe and his wife are invited, and they attend. And Joe is dressed as a lawsuit, which I thought was, you know, quite clever. But you can tell he's not really gone to as much effort as everyone else has at this party. And there's a distinct lack of enthusiasm, which is quite clear. Joe doesn't really want to be there, does he? It's the last place he really wants to be. I think, actually, thinking about it, and I know you're going to touch on it a little bit next, he's there because they're going to discuss the case afterwards. So I think it's probably out of
politeness. They were going through the Q&As, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So that leads me to think that if they'd have done that on a different day, he probably wouldn't have attended the party at all.
Yeah, indeed. But his wife did dress up, didn't she? I can't remember what she dressed up as, but she did partake in the dressing up. Now, this is my favourite scene of the film, and this is the opera scene. With Andrew and Joe. So Tom Hanks is amazing here, but also Denzel Washington is really good because how he uses the silence to make it even more powerful. Now, this scene changes everything for Joe because, you know, we've mentioned about the different where Joe's coming from and it's like the barriers have been broken down. And he also realizes that Andrew is more than just a client with AIDS who also is gay. Now, he sees like the human side of Andrew, and this bit I like as well is where Joe goes back home and he hugs his family and he covers everything from life, mortality and love. So this scene really hit me hard. It was really well done. And Andy, I actually listened to the music for this as part of typing up the notes on YouTube because I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, beautiful scene. Really, really well acted. I just thought it might be worth noting here that before kind of the opera music kicks in, they are having a short exchange at the table where they're chatting. And Miller kind of explains a bit about his upbringing and his thoughts on what he calls alternative lifestyles. And I have to say, you know, I don't want to turn this into a political rant or anything, but it's a real shitty attitude to have. And upbringing is not really much of an excuse as far as I'm concerned. But I do wonder how common this sort of thing is. So, you know, people grow up, they're following their parents' footsteps, they follow their beliefs, their ideas, etc. You know, whether that's political, whether that's, you know, views on racism or sexism or homophobia or whatever that may be. But at some point, the cycle needs to be broken. And I just think this is one of those scenes where it shows that you need to break the cycle, otherwise things will never improve.
Definitely, Andy. Very deep. You see lots of stuff on social media about that, don't you? About you're not born with hate, are you? That is, you see stuff, don't you, where you see kids playing of all different colours and there's no issues there. So like you said, it's very much how they're being brought up with the parents and
absolutely, yeah.
Their attitudes.
I don't want to turn this political or anything, but you see what's happening in the world today and it's just an easy excuse, isn't it? And it brings to mind a phrase, if you always do what you always did, then you'll always get what you always got.
That we don't do quotes in season two. That was season one, but that was a very good quote we could have used, Andy, if we did do quotes in season two.
Well, not a quote from the film. That's just a quote from life.
That indeed, yeah. So let's get back to the film. So Andrew is on the stand and Tom Hanks is brilliant. So he's had some really good scenes now. And the bit where Joe takes a mirror from the other lawyer and asks Andrew whether he has any other lesions. And Andrew then unbuttons his shirt to reveal numerous lesions across his torso. This was very powerful stuff. One of those scenes that when it first started, I recalled it, but I didn't remember before we started watching it.
I'd not recall this, but you're absolutely right. It is a very powerful scene. And I have to say, Andrew does pretty well with the questioning from Miller. But he starts to struggle when it's Belinda who's leading the charge. And when Belinda's finished questioning, she returns to her seat. She mutters to the other people at the desk, "I hate this case." She knows that what she's doing is not right, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. And I wonder, I'm making the assumption that she works for the same company. So I don't know if that is the case. I don't think it's ever explicitly mentioned. I'm just thinking, you know, Andrew Beckett was the person who was basically promoted. You know, he's on course, isn't he? On course to be a partner at one stage. I wonder if she's kind of like next in line, you know, the next bright young thing coming up. Or is she just recruited, you know, hired by a different law firm, you know, because they took it outside of the organisation? I don't know. I don't think it's ever explained.
No, I don't think. I assumed she was in the same company, but
yeah,
I don't know that to be true.
So, shortly afterwards, we see Andrew collapse while Charles Wheeler is on the stand. So Andrew, due to his condition, is no longer able to participate in court and he's bedridden in the hospital.
Now, I would have actually liked to heard more from Wheeler on the stand, as strange as that may sound, because I wanted to know what his justification was or how he's going to try and worm his way out of it. You know, what exactly does he think he's doing in this scenario by firing Andrew? You know, how can he justify his position? Because I'm not saying he's right, because he's clearly not, but I would have liked to have understood how he was going to try and get out of it, and he never really explained it much, did he?
He doesn't, and I wondered, whether, you know, the bit where Andrew collapses, and then I wondered when, you know, the next scene would be Joe continuing to question Charles Wheeler, and I was wondering whether Joe kind of antagonized Charles Wheeler and then he let slip, and then that is what kind of swings the case to Andrew's favor. But no, you're right, it's like that's it, he's collapsed and we don't see any more of Charles Wheeler on the stand.
I like your idea. That would have been a very Hollywood way of doing things, wouldn't it?
It would. But I suppose it goes against Charles Wheeler being, you know, the seasoned professional. He probably never let his guard down, would he?
No, that's true. And I guess it'd be compared with you can't handle the truth, that kind of saying, wouldn't it?
I was thinking that in my head, yeah. So we see the jury reach a verdict, and they award Andrew with some back pay, damages for pain, and also suffering and punitive damages of $4 million, which I believe means he gets around $5 million in total.
I was going to do some maths, and I didn't, but I'm thinking it was $5 million plus. I'm pretty sure of that. I would have liked to have seen a bit more here as well from the jury, you know, a bit more around how they deliberated and made their decision. Could have been padded out a bit more. Just this whole sequence seems quite abrupt to me. The outcome is correct and it gets to the right point, but it just seems to, you're just getting into it and then it's over.
I agree. It definitely seemed rushed, because I thought, and if I remember this correctly, and I don't know what the technical term is, but you know where the jury talk about the case, you only have one scene, don't you, where they're talking behind doors, and I thought there was more of that, and it does seem rushed. It would have been nice to see them kind of deliberating in the back room before they made a decision. Because there is only one scene, isn't there?
I think, yeah, you're right. And is it 11 out of the 12 jurors agree? I think there is one that disagrees.
Yeah, there's one that doesn't, yeah.
And I think having the context as to why that one juror disagreed might have been interesting to see as part of the film, because it's never really explained, is it? It's just kind of there's that quick discussion and then we have the verdict. So I'd have liked to have seen that padded out a little bit more.
Yeah, I just recalled something, which I just quickly checked my quiz because I wanted to make sure I didn't put it on my quiz. But did you notice something during when Andrew Beckett took to the stand and the I don't know if you call him a police officer, where, you know, the bloke that comes with the Bible and you put your hand on it. Did you notice anything about that?
Nothing out of the ordinary that I can remember.
So what happened was, because I thought it was weird and I Googled it. So when the sheriff, police officer, did the Bible, he then left the room and then he came back in. But when he did it with Charles Wheeler, he stayed in the room. He did the Bible. And when you look on the internet, it actually says that the police officer was wearing plastic gloves. So, you know, he didn't touch Andrew. He went out of the room, took off his plastic gloves and came back in. Whereas with Charles Wheeler, he never wore plastic gloves. So it's kind of like emphasizing the whole HIV and AIDS thing. So even like the police officer was apprehensive about touching or being close to Andrew.
So that kind of discrimination, apprehension is in the judicial system as well as just in Joe Public.
Yeah, because there's a bit as well which we didn't discuss, and I can't, it's very early on, you know, where the judge overrules or doesn't allow Denzel Washington to proceed with a question or something.
Yes.
And Denzel Washington,
yes,
kind of looks and you think, oh, is it all going to be biased against him? But obviously that's not the case.
And I vaguely remember the scene you're talking about. Yeah, there was something about the judge at early doors that made me think he was a bit fishy. But yeah, the case is over. The verdict is the correct one. Andrew has won the case. Joe goes to visit Andrew in the hospital. You see various family members and friends are there. And you overhear the doctor telling Andrew's parents and Miguel that Andrew's actually gone blind in his right eye.
Yeah, very sad. And Andrew tells Joe a joke, so he's keeping lighthearted. And Joe then helps Andrew to put his oxygen mask on. And this is another sign that Joe has grown and he's come a long way during the film.
Yeah, there is a bond there. I'm not sure if he's all the way changed his views, because I guess it's always there. I don't know, but it does seem like there is a definite change in his demeanor and mindset, isn't there? We see Andrew's family members say goodnight to him, and they'll see him tomorrow.
Yeah, this was really emotional watching the film. Also, when we were typing up the notes, I was getting very emotional. And I think it didn't help that I was having Bruce Springsteen and Neil Young playing in the background when we were doing this.
You know, there's a few scenes in this that really got to me. And this scene was one of them. And it's the line, "Miguel, I'm ready." Because you know exactly what he means by that. And I just sobbed. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I just sobbed. When I watched that, it was so hard hitting, and I didn't write any more notes after that. It was just such a sad part of the film.
Yeah, it is a very sad film, and I think these type of films, I obviously enjoyed it, and we're going to see our rankings later, but it does make it hard rewatching a film, you know, when you know it's very sad, and the subjects that it discusses. It's not one of those films where you think you watch it every year, is it? It just makes it very difficult.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't, you know, it's not about us. I don't want to make it about us. But do you find that as a father, it hits you a bit differently?
Yeah, because it was interesting. Because as we were watching it, I was saying to the wife about, I don't know. You know, being a parent, you just think about things. And I said something to the missus about, it must be horrible as a parent seeing your child go through stuff like that. So it does. I think you can emphasize more, especially with me. I find that I'm more, I can relate more when I've been through something myself, or I can kind of put myself in that situation, and that makes sense. I'm not someone that's naturally have like the empathy there. So I think, you know, if I was young and single or something like that and didn't have kids, it might have not hit me as hard, but being a parent and thinking, oh, you know, what would that be like if I was in that, you know, position as one of the parents and their, because I think, is he their youngest son? Because he looks the youngest in the video.
He possibly is.
He's one of the younger ones, yeah, not necessarily.
He's definitely got older siblings amongst them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, what about you, Andy? Same question back to you as a dad.
I think so, yeah. I think just generally I'm more emotional and in tune to these sort of things, and just, yeah, obviously this is more than just father and son. There's all kinds of things at play here. So I can't fully relate to the exact situation, but just the whole idea of the sadness, and the discrimination part as well, and the, you know, we're a couple of white middle-aged men, we tend not to get that much discrimination sent our way, it has to be said. We're lucky in that regard, but it just doesn't make sense to me why it exists. And so when you see it, I'm not in the shoes of people that suffer this sort of thing, I just despair as to why it ever happens. And then things like this, I would hate for my son or a family member to go through everything that's talked about in this film, you know, whether it's not just the illness side of things, but the discrimination, the derogatory language, the isolation, and then, you know, to top it off is this scene at the end where, you know, it's time for him to die. And that was it for me. I lost it. I just sobbed.
So Andrew, he dies during the night, and Miguel phones Joe to tell him the sad news.
And then the film closes with the song by Neil Young titled Philadelphia, playing over the wake of Andrew Beckett. We see Andrew's friends and family. They've gathered to say goodbye. And there's a TV set playing a home video of Beckett with his family.
Yeah, this end scene was really well done, and it hit me hard, this one did. So the tissues, I would say the tissues were out, but they weren't out, Andy, because the missus was laying next to me. And I call her the ice princess, because nothing phases her. Whereas I always get tearful in a lot of films. So, yeah. Shall we move on?
Green Room.
So, let's get into the actual film now. So, we've given some facts and figures there. So, the film opens with Michael Sullivan Jr. standing on the beach, looking out to sea, and he's doing a little talk over as well. And you know, spoiler alert, that's how the film ends as well, where he's doing a little talk over.
It is, yeah. And so we see that Sullivan Jr. is a paper boy, and he's riding his bike and in the snow, and he's smoking a pipe as well. Kids were, they were just tougher back then, weren't they?
Well, you could say that, they were tougher. Or I don't know how far his paper round was. Probably very wheezy as he's doing it with a pipe.
He will regret it later in life, that's for sure.
Yeah, you will do.
Smoking's not cool, kids.
So, Andy, when we were typing up the notes, I don't know if you noticed, I made reference to... This was very difficult to keep track because it's Michael Sullivan and then Sullivan, Michael Sullivan Jr. So when we refer to Michael Sullivan or just Sullivan, we're talking about the Tom Hanks character, just to be very clear.
You lay down those ground rules. You know I'm going to forget in about 5 minutes' time, don't you?
Because I know in season one, we reference the actors quite a lot, whereas in season two, we're referencing the characters. And in this one, when we were typing up the notes, it's like, oh, Michael Sullivan. Oh, it's Michael Sullivan Jr. And it was just like, oh, it's getting very frustrating. And I wonder if we trip up when we're doing the recording. Let's see. So Michael Sullivan and his family go to a wake, and the casket is surrounded by ice. And you can see that it's slowly melting.
Yeah, we then get the arrival of John Rooney. And we see John Rooney and the Sullivan kids playing dice together. And we're also introduced at this point to Daniel Craig's character, Connor Rooney, who is the son of John Rooney, played by Paul Newman. And he said, you know, the kids ask, I can't remember exactly what's said here, but he basically introduces himself. And I guess that means to the kids that he is Connor, Uncle Connor.
You know, when you did that, Andy, I questioned myself. So he doesn't actually say that, does he, in the film?
He doesn't actually say, I mean, this is pre-Bond, but he does he does refer to himself as Uncle Connor. And I just couldn't resist because I'm,
no.
I'm a, you know, a teenage boy at
heart. No, but he might have been doing the foundations of the sowing the seeds for, you know, the producers of Bond and slipped in the Connor, Uncle Connor. You know, so that's why I had to, when I saw your note there, I thought, well, I'm going to have to ask Andy about that. Because obviously in, is it Layer Cake when he pretends to be like the James Bond
character? I've not seen it. I don't know. Not seen it.
So Sullivan is sporting a small moustache in the film, and the wife commented he looks like Hitler. So I don't know what you thought about that, Andy, because he obviously has a moustache. It's not a bushy moustache, but it's not a very small one, is it?
I saw your note, and I questioned, does your wife have that face blindness thing again? Because not everyone with a moustache looks like Hitler.
I know. She's crazy, that one.
She's basically, you know, dissed the entire moustache community in one fell swoop, is what she's done.
Yeah, imagine what Movember's like for her. She's probably just going around accusing everyone of being Hitler. She's going to lose it there. But John Rooney, so he gives a speech at the wake, and Finn McGovern follows up, and Rooney basically gets Finn on the stage, and Finn's talking. He's talking about his brother, so it's his brother that's actually died. I don't think you know who's died at that point. Now, you suspect something is going to happen, because as Finn kind of takes, not on stage, but he goes, you know, just his little... talk, you see Connor and Michael slowly start to work their way through the crowd to Finn, and then Finn is talking, and he starts saying about, oh, John is like a ruling god of the town, and that's when Michael Sullivan and Connor take him to one side before he says anything else, or before he says something he might regret.
Yeah, there's an underlying tension that's about to be released, had had Michael and Connor not stepped in at that point. John tells Connor, have a word with Finn later, and to take Michael with him as well. But he stresses, it's only for a chat. Watch this space with that one. And we get a nice little scene next with Michael and John playing the piano, while Connor looks on smiling. And when I saw this, I thought, that's Tom Hanks with a duet on the piano. That seems oddly familiar, doesn't it?
It does seem familiar. I wonder where that's from.
It's a big reference to something, isn't it? But you see the smiling Connor, and it's not a real smile at all. It's a facade. And even the kids see through it, doesn't it? Because one of the kids comes up to him and says, why are you smiling? And he just looks down at this is Peter, isn't it, who asked him the question.
Yeah.
And he just says to him, because it's all so fucking hysterical. So you get the sense here that there is jealousy, isn't there, between of the relationship that his dad John has with Michael.
Yeah. And do you know what I thought about that? Because it's very evident, isn't it, from, you know, early in the film that Connor is jealous of the relationship between Michael and John. Now, do you know what I thought about with this? So I don't know if you thought about it. Was Blofeld and in Bond, you know, in James Bond, where he's jealous of his dad taking James Bond.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
That's what I thought about when this was happening. I thought, oh, the tables have turned, have they? Daniel Craig, you know, you're not happy now, are you? The shoe's on the other foot there. So, yeah, that's what I thought about when this was happening.
Yeah, that's a good callback to season one. Well played there.
So later that night, we see Michael leave the house to undertake the job for John. Now, unbeknown to Michael, Michael Jr. is hiding in the back of the car. Now, this action changes the course of the young boy's life. And Michael picks up Connor and they go into the building to talk to Finn. Now, there's a bit of chit-chat and Connor just seems on edge. And Connor ends up killing Finn and Michael kills the others in the room. And the son sees everything through a hole in a wall. And Connor sees someone when he's talking to Michael, like kind of behind him, that someone's watching. So Michael goes out to find his son crouch at the gate. And he's terrified because he's trying to climb over the gate and he can't get over. So he's kind of like huddled over and he's terrified. He's scared about what's going to happen.
Yeah, this really sets things in motion, doesn't it? And like you said, Connor is definitely unhinged. It tells Michael he's going to walk back home. The next morning, I think it is, John turns up at Michael's house, briefly talks to the boys. He goes to the pub with Michael, and Michael tells John his son's not going to say a word. So there's no issue there. I made a note that slightly earlier in this scene, so as John is talking to Michael Jr., he pays him from the previous night's dice game, gives him a coin of some sort. And I thought this quote was quite poignant when he says, a man of honour always pays his debt and keeps his word. So it's quite a polite way of saying, here, I've paid you your money like I should, now you need to be quiet, is how I saw that.
Yeah. No, yeah, I did too. And if it wasn't for his son, Connor, I don't think John would have done anything. I think he would have just let things progress and leave things as they are. I think only because of Connor's actions, I think, you know, nothing would have happened, basically. So there is a business meeting and there is evident tension between John and Connor. And that's because obviously what's happened the night before, because obviously, as Andy mentioned, John says, just talk to the man, that's it. And obviously Connor ends up killing the bloke. John confronts Connor and Connor ends up apologising to everyone about killing Finn.
Yeah, this is a good scene and we really start to see that father-son dynamic between John and Connor really come to effect here.
And Andy, I didn't put this in the notes because, I just didn't. I could make some excuse, but I didn't. When I was coming up with the quiz, I found this little tidbit. So apparently, you know, when Paul Newman strikes the table, that wasn't in the script. So the reaction of the people around the side of the tables is genuine because Paul Newman kind of added that to that take.
Yeah, that's what makes him so good in his field.
Legendary. So later, Mark was given another job and he's been tasked to go and see a bloke who's racking up a lot of debt. Now, I couldn't remember this bit, but I think it's well played. So, however, just as he's leaving, Connor hands Michael an envelope and tells Michael to deliver it to the gambler. Now, unbeknown to Michael, this letter actually says, "Kill Sullivan and all debts are paid."
Yeah, this... does he actually say that this is a note from my dad or something when he gives him the letter? So, obviously, Michael doesn't read it. It's in an envelope, so he just passes it to whoever he's going to. Can't remember the guy's name. But it becomes pretty obvious that he's being set up. You know, you can see there's a almost like a standoff, isn't there, in the room. And he spots the gun. So before the man can kill Michael, Michael shoots him and the guard. And that's when he reads the letter. And that's when the penny drops. And then in the next scene, which I guess is happening in parallel or at a very similar time frame, we see a masked man at Michael's house. And he kills Michael's wife and their other son, Peter.
Yeah, and before the killer is revealed, Andy, I think it's pretty obvious it's Daniel Craig, you know, because he has piercing blue eyes. So you could tell, as an audience member, you can tell it's Craig. But as, you know, as if we're in the film, obviously Michael Jr. doesn't know it's Connor until he takes off his mask. Now, I thought it was brilliant because it kind of duped my wife. So, you know, you see from Michael's perspective, looking in, it's all lit up. You see Connor take off his mask. But then it's brilliantly done, isn't it, where the camera switches and you see Connor looking at the reflection in the glass and it's all dark outside. Because when he walked out, the wife said, "Oh, how come he's not seeing him?" Because he hides just next to the door, doesn't he? And I said, well, because of the reflection. So, you know, that's why you couldn't see it. I thought that was brilliant how they did that.
Yeah, really, really clever. Because at that very first split second, you think that they're just looking at each other eye to eye. But because of the light, darkness and reflection, he's got away with it. But yeah, very, very well done. I thought that was. I do have a question at this point. So Connor has killed Peter and he's killed Mrs. Sullivan. Two confirmed kills. Does that mean he's got 00 status?
Yeah, it must do. I like your note there, Andy, because you only need one, don't you?
You need two. That's the 00.
Of course, two kills. Sorry. So I'm going to jump now to when we started watching Casino Royale. So I don't know if this is, you know, because I'm showing it in early onset dementia. So you know when at the beginning of Casino Royale, and obviously you have the black and white toilet scene, bathroom scene. That's obviously one kill. So is he saying then he kills the traitor as his second kill? Because because
he's recounting back what happened in the bathroom scene. Because the traitor at the desk says, "Well, you need two kills to be 00."
Yeah, that's when we find out. I can't remember if we discussed that or not. God, my memory's going.
We definitely did. Because I think we made the point that until that point, we weren't sure what made you a 00 or what was it that was kind of the rules.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me, Andy.
But there you go. Thanks for killing my pun there.
Cut that out, Andy. The audience will never know. Just do it where you say you two confirmed kills. Does that mean the worst status? And then just tumbleweed.
I'll put in some canned laughter. But let's get back on track. So Michael returns home and finds his youngest son and wife murdered. Michael Jr. is in a state of shock. Obviously, understandably, very upset about the deaths are both Michaels. But Michael Sr. Gets some bits together and they leave the house.
Now, we see that John hits Connor and then he follows that up with a hug. So he obviously... I'm guessing Connor confessed, or maybe one of the goons that works for John Rooney has told him what's happened. But this is a very complex relationship that they have between the two Rooneys. Now, Connor has gone into hiding, and we find out that Michael is... Well, he's offered $25,000, basically, to forget about everything. But he ends up killing the bloke. Now, I never worked out what $25,000 was in that in, you know, in terms of today's money, but 25k in the 30s, I think this is set, isn't it? Is it 30s? Would have been a lot of money nowadays and then.
Yes, this film is set in 1931. I believe there's a note at the start of the film. I'm going to look it up because I'm curious now. We're going to do some live Googling here on the pod. I just need to spell US. Inflation calculator. Bear with me, listeners. This is going to be riveting stuff that we've got for you here. Load the page. We enter the year. 1931. $25,000. In today's money is just over $500,000.
Blimey.
The interest rate of 1900.8%. So yeah, $500,209. So there you go. My note here was so much for don't shoot the messenger. That's exactly what it does. What I thought was interesting about this scene, though, was as they're talking and, you know, he offers him the money, he basically says, here's $25,000. Go take Peter and hide, sort of thing. So he thinks that Connor's killed Michael Jr. He's killed the wrong son. So Michael and Michael Jr. then travel to Chicago. We've got a short scene where father leaves son in a room full of people. They're all reading the newspapers. I thought this was kind of like the 1930s equivalent of everyone just sat around looking at their smartphones. just a room full of people ignoring each other, reading the newspaper. I thought it was quite a fun visual.
What room do you think that was? Because I couldn't make it out.
I'm assuming some sort of waiting room. Were they in a bank? Or some sort of office building, wasn't it?
Yeah. Because at first I thought it was like a train station because it looked like a tube or something. Because it looked like he walked down, like underground. But it was just, they were just rows and rows, wasn't it, of seats. So it wasn't like, you know, little dotted ones around. So it looked like, I know it obviously isn't, but you know how a church is laid out?
Yeah, I know what you mean, Train station was my initial thought as well, but it seems to be some sort of office setting, doesn't it? But yeah, so the reason they're there, Michael is going to meet Frank Nitti. And Frank warns him that basically he'll be on his own if he continues pursuing Connor.
So when Michael leaves, we see that John was listening to the conversation. So a hitman is hired to take out Michael, but the kid is to be left alone. Now, do you think that's because they think it was Peter that's still alive? And if it wasn't, if they knew that it was Michael Jr., the order would be different.
That's an interesting point. I've not thought of that. So, because I guess it wasn't relayed to them that they'd killed the wrong kid, was it? When I saw it, I took it to just mean that John was being somewhat compassionate, because I don't think he really wanted to kill Michael, did he? But he was just doing what had to be done, but killing a kid was just too far in his estimation.
Yes, yeah. Obviously not for Connor, but for him, yeah. Now, Jude Law's character, Harlan McGuire, is introduced. Now, he's a quirky chap, and he's got a very, I didn't write this down, Andy, but he's got a very interesting kind of hairstyle. And he seems to have two passions, and that's photographing dead people and killing people. Now, Harlan kills the bloke who he was photographing at this crime scene, and he was unexpectedly still alive. So from memory, he pushes in some, like a handkerchief in his mouth and kind of suffocates him. But I thought he was very quirky, the mannerisms. And don't you think about his hair was a bit strange?
It was definitely thinning on top. It was kind of a young man with an old man's haircut. Quirky is a good word. Very eccentric, very odd, very strange. And yeah, the killing and photography piece going together, I think, adds a, not so much a danger, but kind of a cynicism. Is that even the right word? Sinisterness. Sinisterism.
I know it's not the same, but you know when this was revealed, I thought of Dexter. I know it's not exactly the same, but do you know how he's kind of not faking it, but he's got into the kind of like the police so he could carry out a passion in disguise? I know it's not the same, because obviously Dexter only tends to kill bad people.
It's like an evil equivalent, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
So as things roll along, we hear that I think Michael's on the phone, and then Harlan uses some quick thinking to find out where the Sullivans are heading, because he asks the operator to reconnect the call that Michael has just finished on, which I thought was quite clever, considering, you know, we're in the early 1930s. And then he catches up with him later on, and we get a pretty tense scene between Harlan and Michael when they're in a small diner together. They're not sat at the same table, but they are sat opposite each other. And you can tell Michael is a bit suspicious of Harlan, and he's starting to sweat profusely.
He is, and my wife made two comments. One was she didn't realise in those days you can basically do that. And I can't think, you know, there's a code, as when we were growing up, Andy, they introduced a code that you could tap on your telephone and you could find out who called you. So she queried whether that is correct, and it must be, they've used it. But, you know, it's something we weren't were aware of then. But also she made a comment about Harlan having a lot of sugar in his drink as well. So Michael discreetly leaves the diner, and he goes off. I think he pretends to go to the toilet, and he stabs one of the tires on Harlan's car. Now, Harlan comes outside, and he does some shooting, but then also a policeman obviously comes out and he kills the policeman. But he does get some good shots off at Sullivan's car as well. And Sullivan Sr. basically tells Sullivan Jr., his son, to duck, because obviously Jude Law is shooting down the road at him.
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty nifty shot as well from distance, has to be said. The film rolls on. Sullivans need money, so they're robbing various different banks, only taking dirty money, i.e. the mob's money. And Michael Jr. is acting as the getaway driver, so this was the reason he did the real-life driving lessons. So he's the getaway driver for these bank heists, and it's done in kind of a montage fashion. And I thought this was really quite funny, because there's various scenes from the different banks where Hanks's character, Michael Sullivan Sr., is leaving the bank with the money, and the car is trying to get away, and either pulls up really slowly, or it drives too fast, or in some cases it doesn't even stop. Just a nice fun interlude in the middle of the film, I thought. It was quite nicely done. And then later on we see them, I think they may be at a diner themselves or somewhere else, they're having some food. And Junior asks when is he going to get his cut. And his dad says, well, how much do you want? And he thinks about it and he says, $200. And it's a nice scene there, I thought. And then he agrees and he goes, I can't remember the exact words, but it was something along the lines of, I could have asked for more, couldn't I? And he goes, well, you'll never know.
It was nice. Because I wouldn't say, well, I don't know, you could say that the relationship was quite frosty, wasn't it? Then, because he, later on, doesn't he, he said, like, you preferred Peter. And obviously he doesn't, and he explains why. So I think that is a nice little scene. Over these, I think it references, doesn't it, over the 6 weeks, I think this all took place.
Yeah.
That they probably bonded more than they had done up until that point. Now, Michael Sr. is injured when he falls for a trap, but he does injure Harlan, and Alexander Rance is actually accidentally killed by Harlan as well. So the mob have set him up. Now, Michael Jr. takes his dad to this random house, and they meet this friendly elderly couple, and they help remove the bullet. Well, they remove the bullet from Michael Sr., and the Sullivans stay there for a while to recuperate. And there's some nice scenes here, and, you know, the two elderly people do look after him, and they make a comment, don't they, at some point, that they never had children, did they?
I think you're right, yeah. This is obviously a bit of escape for father and son, and you know, they need to recuperate from injuries and just kind of lie low for a bit. So this is where they do that. And yeah, there are some good scenes here. There's quite a touching scene where father and son have a bit of a heart-to-heart moment. And I think this is the point where he says about, you always loved Peter more than me, or something along those lines. And he says, no, I loved you both the same. And it ends with them embracing for a hug. But they've got to move on. So they leave. And they tell the couple, you know, thanks for having us, and we've left something for you. And the couple find it, and it's a bag full of cash. That'll keep them going. I did notice as well, I think they were like $1 and $2 bills, some of them, so it might not have been as much as they think. I could be wrong on that, but I seem to remember it being quite low bills on the top of the pile anyway. But a bag full of cash is a nice gesture at the very, very least. And later on, we were in church. John's in church, and there's a guy praying kind of in the seat behind, and he reveals himself to be Michael Sr., and they need to have a conversation. So they go down to the church basement, and it turns out that John knew all along that Connor has been stealing from him, but he still won't give up his son. Now, I thought this whole thing, I've kind of skipped over it a little bit in terms of the detail, but I would definitely recommend watching it. This was probably my favourite scene. Really, really good interaction between Hanks and Newman here.
It is a brilliant scene. Now, we see John leaving the pub late at night, surrounded by a number of bodyguards. However, that doesn't stop Michael Sr. from killing them all, and this is another good scene as well. You've got the music playing. It's very dark. It's raining, and you don't actually see Michael Sr. because he's in the shadows, and he moves down the bodyguard, and then he basically walks down the street. And just before Michael Sr. kills John, John says something like, well, he says this exactly, not something. I'm glad it's you. And then the camera pans out to the surrounding buildings, and we see people watching what's happened. So I wonder what their thoughts are. Are they happy that the John Rooney, the ruling god, is dead? Or are they a bit apprehensive about, oh, is everything going to change now? Is it going to be like power plays or anything? I'm kind of unsure what people would be thinking about that. Is it the better the devil you know?
Yeah, could well be, yeah. I'd not really thought of it that way. I just thought of it as, oh no, he's been seen, he needs to get out of there. But yeah, there's probably...
there's a lot of witnesses, isn't there?
Yeah, there's it's a bit of a show he's putting on, has to be said. He's not going quietly. But the job's not done yet. Later on, you know, Frank tells Michael Sr. where to find Connor, and Michael kills Connor in the bathtub. No messing about. Walks in, sees him in the bath, shoots him. He's dead. And then Michael Sr. returns to his son, and there's a nice song playing in the background as they embrace.
Andy, what did you think about the bathtub? Because it's very clinical, isn't it? So are you happy with how quick it was, just a kind of a matter of fact? Or, you know, would you like to have seen him beat up Connor a bit? Or because basically he's just giving free range. All the, like, you know, the guards have basically done the lift, opened the door for him. He just walks straight in, I think 2-3 shots maximum, and then he walks out. And then the door, can't remember if it closes or swings, so you see the mirror, don't you, of the bathtub, and you see him dead in it. What did you think, man? Because it is quick. It's just over, isn't it? You know, the film has been building up and up and up in terms of him trying to get Connor and then get the attention of the mob. And then it kind of quickly ends. Kind of reminded me of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think if this was an action film, we'd probably have an extended fight scene here and, you know, Michael fighting from underneath and then just killing his man in the end. This is different. This is personal. This is business at the same time. And I wonder, you know, the way it played out with basically him just being let into the building to shoot him and he's not been stopped along the way. I wonder if that's the rest of the criminal organization basically just admitting that, yeah, we don't want this guy in charge. Things were much better when Dad was around, and now Dad's gone. We can't work for this guy, so do what you need to do.
Yeah, because earlier on, that Frank Nitti has a scene with Connor, doesn't he? And he says something, I can't remember what he says. But then Connor basically says, be careful, don't talk to me like that again. You know, once I'll be taking over my dad's empire at one point, won't he?
Exactly. Craig is the spoiled little rich kid, isn't he, in some regards? But doesn't get enough attention from Daddy.
This next scene, we see the Sullivans reach the house by the sea and the son goes to play with the dog on the beach. Now, the dad goes into the house and he's watching his son play with the dog. So it's a very nice scene, this is.
It is, and we both made the same note here, didn't we? It looks like we're getting a happy ending at this point. And my exact words that I wrote in the notes were, happily ever after awaits, ..
Great minds think alike. So Harlan shoots Michael Sr. So I didn't remember this, but I knew that Tom Hanks' character dies. but I couldn't remember. I was kind of waiting for something to happen. So Harlan shoots Michael Sr. in the back a couple of times, and he's just setting up his camera when Michael Jr. arrives and takes out his gun, and there's this tense standoff because you think, oh, is the boy going to kill Harlan? Is he in shock again? You know, he obviously 6 weeks before this happened, he's seen the aftermath of his brother and mum being killed. Is he just in shock? But thankfully for Michael Jr., Michael Sr. shoots Harlan in the back, and that saves the boy from having to either shoot Harlan or be shot. So he's helped, seen Michael, the dad has basically made a decision for him. And I think, I'm just checking, we haven't wrote this in the notes, I can't remember if this is mentioned, Andy, and correct me if I'm wrong, at least it's implied, a Michael Sr. basically says that Michael Jr. is like him, and by him killing Harlan is kind of making sure that Michael Jr. doesn't get involved in terms of like killing people, is how I interpreted that.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's the scene earlier we talked about where they have a bit of heart to heart, and he basically says something like that Peter is like the mum, he's a very sweet boy, whereas Michael Jr. is very much like Michael Sr. But of course, he doesn't want him to be like Michael Sr. because of the, you know, criminal element of what he does for a living. So, Michael Sr. is the one that takes the shot, says sorry a few times, and then dies. But I think it's safe to say at this point he dies proud that his son didn't pull the trigger. And then Michael Jr. returns back to the old couple, and he's got the dog in tow.
So, two comments here, Andy. This is 2 weeks in a row that Tom Hanks dies in the film. Very different endings. But also, what happened to Aunt Sarah? Because this is Aunt Sarah's house, isn't it?
It is. Aunt Sarah lives by the beach, but she's nowhere to be found, and she's never seen.
Which I thought, you know, considering that Michael Jr. went off to live with the old couple, I wonder if Aunt Sarah's dead. Did the hitman take out Aunt Sarah and she's dead in the house because she was there already? Do you know what I mean? Like,
That could be the case, or, you know, maybe there's going to be a Road to Perdition 2 where Aunt Sarah gets her revenge on... well, there's no one left to get her revenge on, is there? The old couple, the dog?
Aunt Sarah's going to come back. Because, Andy, you know where you said the bag of money is $1 or $2 bills? Now, obviously, Junior and Senior have been robbing banks, and they've been keeping all the money in the car. So I'm assuming when he drives back to the old couple, the car's just full of all the other money, is how I assumed the film ended. So they're rolling in it.
They've done pretty well for themselves, haven't they? Yeah. This mysterious
he's only
couple.
Lost his family, but, yeah, you know.
He's got a new one now, and a dog.
Now, the film opens with men running through field with guns and pitchforks. And then the film cuts to an old man in a care home, and it's Paul Edgecombe. Now, Paul and Ella are talking over a copper, and he starts talking about John Coffey. Now, the film cuts back to the past, and this is where the majority of the film stays now.
Yeah, so we're back to the 1930s, and we see John Coffey walking into cell block E. He is massive, and he's chained up. And we have Percy, one of the guards, and we'll be talking about him at various points throughout this, but he's dragging him along best he can, and he's going, "Dead man, we got a dead man walking here, dead man walking," just over and over again. Absolute tool.
He is so annoying, isn't he? Straight away, you just know. He reminded, obviously, this bit, because I didn't really remember that character. But then when he came on, Andy, doing that bit, I thought, oh, I remember. Then it reminded me of the whole sponge thing and everything. The actor played it really well, didn't he?
Indeed, he did, yes. I made the note, what a tool. I made that note several times throughout, as you will hear, no doubt. But we're introduced to the guards, including Percy, and he makes an immediate impression, doesn't he? He's a weasel. He's very annoying. He's... Yeah, he's not a nice guy. I guess it brings to mind that phrase, you only get one chance to make a first impression. And he doesn't make a great one. And we see one of the prisoners, Edouard Delacroix, in his cell, and Percy hits him with his baton or something, doesn't he, and damages his fingers. So that gives you an idea of what he's like.
Yeah, abusing the prisoners. We do have a flashback now to two little girls going missing, and the search party find Coffee crying, and he's holding the two little girls. He says something along the lines of, I tried to take it back, but it's too late. Now, Paul Edgecombe has a UTI, and he's really struggling as well. And we are introduced to the mouse that we both mentioned earlier on, and he does become an important cast member. Now, I just want to say something, Andy, because obviously this film is over 3 hours long, so we might jump around, might we, when we're talking about bits, but we've tried to keep the episodes to 1 hour, so there might be bits that we kind of jump forward, don't
indeed we will skip over a few things. I tried to keep my notes quite limited because nobody wants to hear me talk for many hours, we're not going scene by scene, we're just kind of going some of the notes we wrote down. And the mouse was something we both wrote notes on. I thought it was a very, really cute scene, actually, to start with the mouse. And then we get a not-so-cute scene when Percy sees the mouse. And my note here was, what a tool. Further along, we see the guards going through a dry run of the execution for prisoner Bitterbuck. They talk through the process, and there's a note here that I made. The sponge has to be wet. And I made that note purposely because I remembered it would be an important part of the procedure.
It is a very important part of the procedure. Now for the real thing, and the electric chair doesn't kill him on the first attempt, and have to turn the power on again. It's very grim, isn't it, now?
It is, yeah, but it's all part of the job. And all while this is happening, Percy is looking on, and he's got that look of, I would say morbid fascination, I would word it. And my note here was, what a tool. You're getting the idea, aren't you, with Percy and my feelings?
Yeah, and then just to make a note here, this is obviously he's in the, I don't know what you call it, he's in a little side room, isn't he? So he's not up front, is he, at this point? And that's an important point later on, because he obviously wants to go up front. So he's watching behind the barrier.
There's like a privacy screen type thing, isn't it? Where,
yes, that's it.
Where the guy who flicks the switch stays. And I'd not really thought why that might be. I assume it's just so you don't actually know who's the one doing the killing. So you can't put a face, or you can't put a name to the actual execution. Maybe, I'm just guessing.
Yeah, maybe that's, you know, with the bloke with the, you know, when you get beheaded, tends to have a mask on, doesn't he? Because it's just a job, isn't it, to him? Now, moving on, we are introduced to a new prisoner. Brilliant Sam Rockwell, and he plays Wild Bill. Now, Wild Bill looks really doped up, and you see a few minutes where he's kind of comatose, but, you know, you think, oh, they're pumped in full of drugs, but obviously you find out it's just an act. And he fights the guards, and Percy freezes, and Edgecombe is injured as well. Now, Coffee helps Edgecombe afterwards, because Wild Bill kicks or punches him in the stomach, well, in the groin area, and he goes down and he's really suffering, and Coffee helps Edgecombe and he heals his UTI. And this is obviously the bit that Andy did recall. And we see the glowing light bulbs that shatter, and then he coughs up this black stuff that kind of flies away, disappears away, kind of ascends, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was, I don't know if they were like bugs or whether it was just, yeah, but they did disappear, didn't they? It was really weird. But this is where we're starting to get a little bit more insight into what Coffee's actually all about and his healing powers. Now, one person who's very happy that Paul is healed is Mrs. Edgecombe. In fact, I think she was pleased four times a night, if memory serves me correctly. Now, later on, Edgecombe goes to see Coffee's lawyer, Bert Hammersmith. And we see that this is played by none other than Gary Sinise, Lieutenant Dan. Bert doesn't believe that Coffee's innocent, though. So I think the point of this scene is that there's doubt creeping in Paul's mind as to whether Coffee actually did what he's being accused of. But Bert's pretty clear that he thinks he's guilty. I thought it was a very, very good scene. But we are getting that sense that Johnny's actually a good guy. But for me, this conversation continued to cast some doubt over it. I thought it was really, really well done because it didn't give away the game fully. You know, you kind of know where things are heading at this point, but the way this scene was done, that doubt is still there for me.
Yeah, definitely. It is a good scene. And he plays a very different character, doesn't he, to Lieutenant Dan, the Bert Hammersmith, because obviously he starts talking about the dog, doesn't he, and his son getting injured. So yeah, it is a good scene. Now that is the last time we see actually Bert Hammersmith as well. So it's a kind of a little cameo scene that he's in. Now Wild Bill spits on Edgecombe, and then he gets hosed down by the guards after he pisses on Harry's feet and legs. We need to obviously beep that out, Andy. I don't like to swear, Andy.
I think pisses is okay. Piss is an acceptable swear. That's YouTube friendly. Yeah.
I have to mention when it's explicit language.
No, piss is fine. Piss all over YouTube. There's a funny bit where obviously Harry's been pissed on, and he's got the hose in his hand, and he just says, "Piss on me," and hoses him down. I thought that was a really funny line.
That is Andy. And do you recognise the actor and that played Harry and the earlier mention of the Walking Dead TV programme? Did you recognise him?
I didn't at the time, but now you've said it. Yes, I do.
He plays Dale.
Yeah.
Who was only in the first couple of seasons, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was one of the early characters. Yeah, that's... I'm learning as we're recording.
Now, Wild Bill is dragged to the padded room. Later on, we see Wild Bill again, and he spits chocolate over Brutus Howell's face. So he's very wild. He's living to his nickname.
He is a little tinker, isn't he? And later on, Percy gets grabbed by Wild Bill, and Percy wets himself. Delacroix laughs at Percy. Percy's made Delacroix's life a bit difficult, so of course, Delacroix is quite amused by this. But Percy doesn't forget, and he'll get his revenge later.
Now, Percy kills a mouse, but John Coffey brings it back to life as the four guards watch in wonder. I think this is another good scene, and we get the glowing light bulbs again and the black dust again.
Yeah, so JC has shown himself to be something of a healer to more than just Paul now. More on that to come. But we go then to the execution of Delacroix. There's a whole big lead up to it that we won't go into here, but very good scenes throughout as they're approaching this. And Percy deliberately doesn't wet the sponge. Now, I mentioned this earlier. This is gonna cause a problem. And he also spitefully tells Delacroix that there's no such thing as a mouse, Phil. And again, what a tool. Just, just needlessly spiteful and just terrible. I do have a little side note here, though. Do we know what it was that Delacroix did? I'm assuming it's got to be pretty bad because it's got him the death penalty. But on the surface and the way the character is portrayed in Death Row, he seems like quite a sweet and simple man. So it doesn't register. He must have done something horrendous, but do we know what it was?
We don't know in the film, but it is explained in the book, Andy. So he seems a sweet and simple man, but when I'm going to tell you something, Andy, you're going to have second thoughts about this. Now, he's in prison because he raped and killed a little girl. And then to hide the evidence, he burnt down the building. But there were five or six people in the building, including children, so they died as well. So that is covered in the actual book, but it's never mentioned in the film.
So not so sweet, simple man. In fact, fuck Delacroix. Fuck that motherfucker. There, I'll get the beeper button out.
Because when you think about it, Andy, he's pretty much done what Wild Bill... You find out Wild Bill has done.
Yeah, but he seems so nice.
Wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking forward to reading the book, and I wonder if it goes in a bit more deeper into that, and I wonder what his character's like in the book. If he's, like you said, sweet and simple man in the film? Is that how it's portrayed in the novel?
Yeah, very, very interesting. But yeah, I take back my sweet and simple comment if indeed that's what he's done in the film. Let's just say in the film version, he just did some petty theft, like some shoplifting or something. That was all it was.
Now, Edgecombe notices that the sponge is dry, but it's too late. Now, the switch is turned on and Delacroix goes through this very painful execution that seems to last for ages. Now, this scene was very grim and very dark. It was quite difficult to watch, Andy, this particular scene. And it was difficult for Percy to watch because at one point he tries to turn around, doesn't he? But poor Edgecombe makes him watch.
He does, and rightly so.
Yes, because even the, what do you call it? The audience, the people that just want to go and watch.
The viewing some gallery.
Yeah. Even some of those were struggling as well, and they were trying to...
I think they all ran out of the room, didn't they, as it progressed, yeah.
Yeah, and the warden even mentioned something about the smell staying around for years, doesn't he? I can't remember his exact quote, but he does say something like that.
Yeah.
Now, later on, the guards are talking about taking coffee to Melinda Moore's, and that's obviously the warden's wife, as it is revealed earlier that she does have a brain tumour.
The guards drug Wild Bill, they put Percy in a straitjacket, and they throw him into the padded room for, as punishment, isn't it, for Delacroix. And then they take coffee to Melinda. It's about 2:30 in the morning, the warden's not expecting him. Obviously very apprehensive, I think he's even got a shotgun. He doesn't really want this to happen, but this is a really, really good scene, really powerful. We see John performing his magic, and you know, it kind of emanates all around the room, doesn't it? The room shakes, the clock stops, the house is rocking, and he's taken away the brain tumour, or at least that's the implication. Straight away, Melinda's looking younger, she's looking healthier. She's completely cured of this incurable brain tumour.
Yeah, it's a very good scene, this, Andy, isn't it? Because John Coffey, he's kind of has the awareness that something's wrong, doesn't he? Because he approaches the house and he's very gentle. And obviously the warden is very apprehensive about it. But it's a very, very good scene. And also, we didn't write this down, he hasn't breathed out the black dust, has he, yet? And I think it's either Paul Edgecombe or Brutus mentions that, don't they? They say, don't you need to kind of like spit it out or breathe it out, don't they? They make it.
Yeah, he's doubled over on the floor coughing, isn't he? But he's not actually spat anything up.
Indeed. Now, they take coffee back to prison and they let Percy out of the padded room. Now, coffee grabs Percy and he breathes this black dust stuff into his mouth. Now, obviously, you know, he's been holding it in. This surprised me, Andy, because I didn't remember any of this bit. Percy is kind of like in shock when this has happened, but he kind of like starts walking back down the aisle, and he's walking past Wild Bill, and then he stops and he turns around and then pulls out the gun and kills Wild Bill, and then the black dust then leaves Percy. So I didn't remember any of this.
No, I didn't remember that either, but that's karma for you, isn't it?
That is karma.
Very, 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 very well done. A bit surprised. I've not made a note of this, but it's a bit surprising that, considering John Coffey's character so far, it's surprising that he would have done something like that, which was quite, you know, vengeful, as it were. You know, not just... not just turning the other cheek and forgiving like another famous JC might.
Indeed, and it's very much two birds with one stone as well. So it's, yeah, and I don't know what your thoughts are, Andy. I know we haven't finished the film yet, so I don't know if you think it's a kind of God-given gift, or is this more of a fantasy element, and it's just some kind of like magical power that he's kind of been born with. I don't know. I didn't give it much thought. Obviously, Paul Edgecombe is leaning towards the religious side, isn't he? Because he's a God-fearing man.
I think there is... he might have made mention to it earlier about it's like he came down from heaven or something. Not, there's not an exact quote, but it was something along those lines. And his initials are JC.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. Edgecombe asks Coffee why he did it, and Coffee shows him a vision. And this is obviously when we find out that Wild Bill was the one who killed the two little girls. And I'm sure he did a lot more other things as well.
Yeah, that's a really powerful scene as well. And we'll play into what happens a little bit later on. Now, Percy, because of his actions, ends up in the mental hospital, Briar's Ridge, I believe it is, which is a fitting end for him because that's where he was wanting to work, wasn't it? That's where he was going to transfer to. And he has been transferred there, just not in the capacity that he was expecting.
And I'm quite, because you know when they were talking earlier on in the film and they were saying that he's basically looking to transfer to a mental hospital. I was just thinking that must be the worst place for him to go because he's just going to abuse the patients, isn't he? And no one's going to believe the patients because of the mental health patients. So I think, you know, like you said, it's a very fitting end to that character arc.
We have another good scene between Coffee and Edgecombe, where they're talking about God and the execution, and Edgecombe's worried what will happen to him when he dies and he's at the pearly gates. So again, that was kind of religious overtones being spoken about, not necessarily directly implicated, but sort of alluded to, aren't they?
Yeah, that is a good scene because it's poor Edgecombe. He pulls up a chair. You got Brutus Howell just behind him, and they're just talking to Coffee in his cell. It's very good. Now, it's the night of Coffee's execution, and we see Coffee, and he's very relaxed, and he's at peace. He's obviously mentioned to Paul Westcombe, didn't he? Because Paul Westcombe said something like, "Do you want me to like let you go or like open the doors?" And John Coffee, I can't remember his exact quote, but he was saying it was like glass or something, you know, in his head, or you know, it was like the pain. I can't remember the exact quote he says, but he was just basically in constant pain, wasn't he? So
yeah, he mentioned something about being tired and how the world is full of hate and he can feel it all the time.
Yeah, lucky he wasn't on social media these days, wasn't he? So
a modern day film of the Green Mile is nowhere near as heartwarming or powerful, that's for sure.
So he is at peace and he's relaxed. However, he does get scared when he enters the room where the electric chair is, and he feels all the hate from the public. And I think it's the dad of the two dead girls shouts some stuff out, and the mother does at some point as well. And the guards tell Coffee to feel how they feel, so they kind of like have their love for him. Now, Coffee does ask not to be masked because he's scared of the dark. So they're going to see his expression throughout the execution, which must be very daunting, off-putting, must be upsetting for the guards, especially they know what kind of abilities he has. Just before it happens, I thought this was touching, Edgecombe, he kind of touches Coffee's hand, and I'm not quite sure if it's a handshake. I think it's just kind of like just grabs his hand, doesn't he? And then Coffee is obviously electrocuted.
Yeah, it's kind of handshake grab, but not a full-on handshake of two men meeting. I think that would be quite not dangerous, but it's quite a controversial thing to do, because obviously in the minds of everyone else in the room other than the guards who know different, you know, this is a cold-blooded killer. Why would you shake his hand?
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think, Andy, the warden is present, is he, during the execution?
I don't recall seeing him in this scene, I'll be honest. But yeah, he's, like you said, he's electrocuted. Now, I did have a question at this point around the guard who flicks the switch behind the privacy screen. He doesn't know about Coffee and his powers, does he? Because when we think back to earlier in the film, when obviously the guards see what he does with the mouse, he's not part of that crew, and he's not part of the crew that takes him to Melinda's either. So I'm assuming he doesn't know. In fact, I don't actually recall seeing him in any place other than working the switches.
I agree. And I thought that as well, Andy. So was he crying? Because I thought he looked like he was crying.
I'm not sure. I think he may have been the only one who was somewhat neutral. That's what made me think of that, is that he wasn't acting particularly upset, or at least from memory. I don't recall him being particularly upset, and I don't recall seeing him in the scene, so that makes me think that maybe he's not privy to what Edgecombe and the other guards know. But it's bye-bye John Coffey in quite a sad scene, has to be said. We're back to the present day, and then Edgecombe explains that it's him. Him and Brutal changed jobs after that night. They couldn't go through any more executions. And then Paul and Ella go to a cabin in the woods, and we find out that Mr. Jingles, the mouse, is still alive. And not only that, but Edgecombe is 108 years old. So his the mouse being alive is incredible for that amount of time. So this is, let me do the maths on this, because I think he says he was 44 when John Coffey came into the room. So this would have been 64 years later, which would probably fit with the timing of the mid-30s, early to mid-30s setting and the late 90s release. But yeah, he's 108 years old, and I think he even says something, doesn't he, about that his punishment is to be alive when everyone around him dies or something.
He does, yeah, because he mentions some people dying, and he mentions his wife, Brutus Howe, and obviously we see Ella as well in her open coffin. So I wonder, Andy, and I shouldn't laugh, but this reminded me of the film Highlander. Now, you might wonder why, but in Highlander, the character, you know, Christopher Lambert plays, I can't remember his name, McLeod? He says, doesn't he? He keeps moving, so no one ever gets suspicious. I wonder if that's what Paul Edgecombe does, or he just basically stays in the same care home, and he's just like really old.
It's weird, because he is clearly an old man, but not necessarily 108 years old to look at. So it's not like he's, I don't think he's immortal, is he? Because he's not. He doesn't look like Tom Hanks, because it's not Tom Hanks. But do you know what I mean? He's just aging a little bit slower than others around him. But that kind of brings us to the end. Like we said, we've kind of skipped over quite a lot there, but it's a long film, but a lot of good scenes to go over. We've just picked out the ones that were noteworthy, but that's a little flavour of what the Green Mile was like. We've maybe not done the full mile. Maybe it's like the green half mile we've given you there. The Radio Room.